Okay, so this is to Vajragota on fire. And just to review a little bit of what we covered, there was a wanderer by the name of Vajragota who would always come to the Buddha and ask him questions on various matters. And Vajragota was especially obsessed with these speculative views that were being debated amongst the different schools of philosophy in India in the Buddha's time. That is, the 10 speculative views, whether the world's eternal, not eternal, finite, infinite, whether the soul and the body are the same, soul and body are different, and then especially the 4 views about what happens to a Tathagata, an enlightened person, after death. And the Buddha refuses to answer any of these views. And as we brought out last time, there were 2 reasons why the Buddha doesn't answer these views. One is that the Buddha says that all of these views are what he calls a thicket of views, a wilderness of views, a contortion of views, a fetter, and all of these views are beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and they don't lead to enlightenment and to nibbana. Okay, so that is, you say, one reason why the Buddha doesn't hold any of these speculative views. And then, now we come to page 592, the Buddha gives, maybe this is a second reason, but to go to ask the Buddha whether he holds any kind of view at all. And then the Buddha says that speculative views are something that the Tathagata, the enlightened one, has put away because he has seen the nature of the 5 aggregates, their origin, and their disappearance. And so he says, I pointed out last week that there's a kind of wordplay here that's apparent in the Pali, it doesn't come through well in English. What's called a view in Pali is ditti. And the word view, it comes from the verb which means to see. Dasati. And then from the same verb, we get the past participle, which is ditta, which means seen. But there's a subtle difference between a view and what one has seen. A view is a subjective opinion, an interpretation, a viewpoint, whereas what one has seen is something that one has directly perceived and directly understood and penetrated, you could say. And so the Buddha says that he has put away all ditti, or dittigatta, all reliance upon views, because ditta, what he has seen, is material form, it's the body, its arising, its disappearance, feeling, perception, volitional activities, consciousness, its arising and passing away. So then he says that because he has seen all of this, he says, with the destruction, fading away, cessation, giving up, and relinquishment of all conceivings, all excogitations, all eye-making, mind-making, and the underlying tendency to conceit, the Tathagata is liberated through not clinging. And these words are quite important, as I pointed out last time. conceivings, or we could say misconceivings, misconceptions. These are ideas that are mentally fabricated on the basis of, you could say, the raw material of experience. We say that they're ideas that are pure conceptual or mental constructions. And the most important, from the Buddha standpoint, of these ideas that are constructed are the ideas of I and mine. This is called I-making and mind-making. And so from the Buddha's point of view, the reason why all of these views originate, they originate because we misconceive or misinterpret, misconstrue our experience, which consists, when you look at it clearly and objectively, it consists of these five aggregates, the interplay of the five aggregates. And based on the interplay of the five aggregates, there arises, through conceptual distortion, the idea of I, that I have some kind of true self or true individual ego behind or within the experience. And then correlated with the idea of I, there comes the idea of mine. This is my territory, my possessions, my book, my recorder, and even most intimately, this is my body, my thoughts, my intelligence, my creativity, my artistic talents. All of these ideas that I am this, I am that, this is mine, this belongs to me. All of this, for the Buddha, is just conceptual distortion, a product of erroneous mental activities. It's a ghost comes to it.
Monte, before you get to that liberated statement, view is relevant because if you have a wrong view,
this is a very good point. Yeah. The Buddha does emphasize the importance of having the right view. Right view is the first factor in the Noble Eightfold Path. But here what he's talking about are these speculative views, views that go beyond the bounds of possible experience. Yeah, but that's a good point.
But it's once you get to the liberated state, that's when view becomes, I don't know if irrelevant is the right word, but obviously you're beyond that point.
When one gets to the liberated state, then one will have seen, one has seen the content of the right view. And so one will still have the right view, but it's no longer now a matter of opinion, but it's something that one has seen for oneself. But because of this, maybe this is already implied in the last phrase here, that the Tathagata is liberated through not clinging. So he doesn't cling to any ideas of I and mine. Those are completely discarded. And even when he holds right view, there's no clinging to that right view.
Is this because views are just like anything else, they're impermanent and they are like conventional truths and absolute truth? Is that the thinking behind it?
The you repeat it into the microphone, because he wants it to be picked up by the recorder.
Sure. Is it because views, just like anything else, is impermanent and changing, and views themselves are conventional, they're not absolute in one sense?
Yeah, all views are conventional, and they're based on what is impermanent, but we would still distinguish amongst the impermanent views those that are wrong views, which misconstrue the nature of things, and those which are right views, views that accord with the nature of things and that will lead one to insight, to wisdom, and to liberation. Okay, so the key point here is that at the end of this paragraph he says, by giving up all misconceivings, I-making, mind-making, and the tendency to conceit, the Tathagata is liberated through not clinging. So the basic form of clinging is the clinging to the ideas of I and mine. And then through the ideas of I and mine, these speculative views emerge, and what clings to them, and one has feels obliged to defend my view against other views. And so in this way, these philosophers and thinkers of the Buddha's time became embroiled in these constant debates between one point of view and another. But the Buddha says, by giving up all I-making and mind-making, then there's no more clinging. And with the end of clinging, one is liberated. I wanted to look at a few of the other passages which deal with the reason why the Buddha rejects all of these speculative views. And these are what I had printed out and handed it out the last time, or most people printed them out last time. Oh, these are from the Samyutta Nikaya, which are translated as the Connected Discourse. Okay, one time, this is two monks, Sariputta and his friend Kotita, are having a discussion, and one of them, I think it's Sariputta, asks Kotita, what is the reason why none of these views have been approved of or propounded by the Buddha? And then Kotita says, it is one who is not devoid of attachment or lust for form, who is not devoid of desire, affection, thirst, passion, and craving for form, who thinks the Tathagata exists after death, the Tathagata does not exist after death, the Tathagata both exist after death, the Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist after death. So all four of these views originate, according to this sutta, because of attachment to form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness. But then the text goes on and it says, for one who is devoid of attachment or lust for form, for feeling, perception, volitional activities and consciousness, these views are not adopted. And so then he says, that's the reason why this has not been declared by the Blessed One. Another sutta, this is number 6 in chapter 44 of the Samyutta Nikaya. Sariputta, this time, explains, it is one who delights in form, who takes delight in form, feeling, perception, volitional activities, and consciousness, and who does not know and see the cessation of form, feeling, perception, and so on, who thinks the Tathagata exists after death, the Tathagata does not exist after death, and so on. So all of these views originate because of Again, here it's delighting and rejoicing in the five aggregates. Again, these are ways of expressing the clinging to the five aggregates. Okay, then there is still another sutta. And here again, it's the wanderer Vajragota comes up to the Buddha's disciple Moggallana, and Vajragota asks, does the Tathagata exist after death? And Moggallana says, the Tathagata has not said the Tathagata exists after death. Then the questions go through the four alternatives. Then Vajragota asks, what is the reason why, when the wanderers of other sects are asked these questions, then they will answer? Some will answer that the Tathagata exists after death. Some will say that the Tathagata doesn't exist after death. Some will say that the Tathagata both exists and doesn't exist after death. Others will say that the Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist after death. But when the Buddha is asked these questions, then he doesn't give these answers. What is the reason? Then Moggallana explains that the wanderers of other sects regard, this time he speaks about the six senses, the eye, ear, nose, tongue, and mind. They regard them as, this is I, if this is mine, this I am, this is myself. Therefore, when the wanderers of other sects are asked such questions, they give such answers as the Tathagata exists after death, and so on. But the Buddha regards the eye, ear, nose, tongue, and so on as, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. And so when he is asked such questions, he doesn't give such answers. Still another sutta, this is sutta number 8 in Samyutta Nikaya, chapter 44. Vajragota comes to the Buddha and asks, why is it that the wanderers of other sects answer these questions, and when you are asked these questions, you don't give any answers? Then the Buddha says that the wanderers of other sects regard the five aggregates, form, feeling, perception, and so on, regard them as self, as possessing self, whereas they regard the self as possessing form, they regard form as in the self, or they regard self as in form. Therefore, when they are asked such questions, they answer it that way. But the Tathagata, the Buddha, doesn't regard form, feeling, perception, and so on as self, or self as in the five aggregates. And so when he is asked such questions, he doesn't give any of these answers. Okay, so this is basically some other sutras which help to shed some light on these questions. And now I want to just briefly look at these four. Oh, Richard, okay.
Yeah, just you, on the sheet that you handed out, you also have Sutta 1.
I'm going to come to Sutta 1.
Oh, okay.
After, yeah, I'm going to come to that. Four alternatives. Of the 10 questions, I think these were the sort of most hotly disputed questions about what happens to the Tathagata after death. And so we have four positions here. One position is the view that the Tathagata exists after death. And this is a view which in the Buddhist text is called eternalism. So eternalism eternalism will hold that in some way the Tathagata has some kind of inner essence, like a self, a spirit, a soul. And so when the enlightened person passes away, you could say that the body and even the mind and mental faculties all come to an end, but then the soul or spirit or true essence remains eternally. And this was a view that was quite widespread in India in the Buddha's time, even down to the present day. We find these views articulated in texts like the Upanishads, which holds that at the core of every person there is a kind of immutable, infinite self, which is found within the heart. And even though we go from life to life, then the self transmigrates from life to life. It's the self that transmigrates from life to life. But the task for the spiritual seeker is to discover this innermost self. When one discovers the innermost self, then one breaks the cycle of rebirths, and the empirical person comes to an end, but the true self will abide forever. That true self is said to be the Atman or the Brahman, the eternal reality. Okay, there was another view which was held in the Buddha's time, not by as many people, but by a certain select group of thinkers and philosophers. This is the view that is called annihilationism. And this is the view that when a person dies, everything comes to an end. There is nothing that survives at all. We find this view, for example, articulated, I think, in Sutta number 76. Yeah, on page 619 in the Majjhimanikaya. Often the annihilationist view goes along with a view which denies that there's any value in moral action, in ethical action. So we have the view when there is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed, no fruit or result of good and bad actions, neither this world nor another world, no value in serving one's mother or father. There are no beings who are reborn spontaneously, and no virtuous ascetics who have understood the nature of the world. So a person consists of the four great elements. This is the kind of materialist view that the reality are just the material constituents of a person. And then from the interplay of the material elements, mind or consciousness arises. Sometimes they use the analogy of with an alcoholic drink, like maybe they had the kind of beer made from grain in the Buddha's time. So when you mix the ingredients of the grain, water, and yeast, then the beer gets this kind of intoxicating property. That's just a byproduct of the chemical formations in the beer. So consciousness is just a byproduct of the material processes of the body. And therefore, when a person dies, the earth returns and goes back to the great earth. The water returns to, you know, the cosmic water. The fire returns to cosmic heat. And air returns and goes back to the cosmic air. And the faculties, the mental faculties, just dissolve in space. And so there's nothing left but the remains of the cremation. So this is a view that has become quite a widespread view today. Even very respected scientific thinkers, many of them hold this view, that the only reality is material reality. Mind or consciousness does not have any kind of fundamental existence, but it's a subordinate or a, they use the expression, epiphenomenon, a byproduct of the material processes of the body, especially the brain, because of the complexity and the cellular structure of the brain, and maybe because of certain developments that took place through biological evolution. First animals and then human beings have developed mind or consciousness. But when we die, nothing survives. Everything is obliterated. Okay, so this is the view of annihilationism. The third position is a little more obscure, and this is a position which is called sometimes, this is the position which is stated here in the text as the Tathagata both exists and does not exist after death. And this would be the view that sometimes is called partial eternalism, which would mean that there is some part of the Tathagata which is eternal and part which is transient or not eternal. And so what happens to the Tathagata at death is that the non-eternal part perishes, but the eternal part survives. I have to say, I'm not so clear what the distinction would be between this view and eternalism, because the eternalists don't say that everything about an enlightened person will survive in eternity. Of course, they don't hold that the body will survive. So it's not really so clear to me what the distinction is. But it could be that this view, the Tathagata, both exists and does not exist. Perhaps this could be a view which will hold that in certain respect the Tathagata exists, in certain respects he does not exist. Maybe they will say the Tathagata exists and that there's some kind of eternal essence of the Tathagata which continues to be, but the eternal existence of that Tathagata, or that eternal reality of the Tathagata, is so different from our ordinary reality that we can't even use the word exist in its normal sense to refer to it. Richard, maybe you have some idea.
I'm wondering if you could have some similarity, say, to the Roman view that after death you pass over the river Lethe, and then you forget everything in your life. Yep. With the soul that survives, yep, has no contact with your previous life and no memory of it. Mm-hmm. And so, in other words, the self that you had, which you identified as a creature, you know, as a person of a particular life, that's what's gone. Mm-hmm. But there's still something else remaining.
It could be.
It sounds similar.
It could be. It could be. In fact, we find the partial eternalism view is stated in the Brahmajala Sutta. That's the first sutta in the Digha Nikaya. The way it's expressed there, the one who adopts this view says that there are these six faculties, the six faculties of the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. And what happens for the enlightened person at death, the five physical sense faculties perish, but the mind faculty continues to survive. So maybe that's similar to this Roman view. Okay, then the fourth view is expressed with the thesis, the Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist after death. And this view is usually regarded as the standpoint taken by a group of thinkers in the Buddhist time who are called The term used is amaravikapa, which means literally eel wigglers. You know the eel, that kind of snake-like creature that lives in the water? Because you can never catch with your hands the eel. It's so evasive that it's always slipping away. And so those who take this kind of view refuse to make a commitment to any position. It seems a little bit like the Buddhist point of view, except that they say that the reason that they refuse to make a commitment is that it's impossible for the human intelligence to resolve these kinds of problems, that these problems are just beyond the range of human reason. And so when they're asked about these questions, they say, I don't say it's this way, I don't say it's that way.
And that one sounds like Pyrrhonism. That is a Sectus Empiricus, a similar view of it. The idea of epoche, of bracketing, comes from Sectus Empiricus, saying, look, just bracket all these metaphysical beliefs.
Yeah.
Don't have any, they're not going to help you, you don't need them, and so on. But it's he was called a skeptic for this, and he tried to refute all of the academic doctrines of the logicians, the mathematicians, and so on and so forth. And you're saying there's no point to metaphysics at all.
Yeah.
That also became the root of David Hume's reflections.
Yeah, this sounds a little, it sounds a little bit like, well, let's say it has some similarities to the Buddha's own standpoint, which is not to take up the metaphysical speculations because we can never really know. Well, for the Buddha, it's not a matter that we can't know the truth behind them. It's just that all of these speculations are based on an underlying wrong view or wrong presupposition, which is the view of a real I and mine, a real self.
Yeah, the conclusion is similar. Although it seems like the categorization is somewhat different because the Buddha is rejecting that view. I'm wondering, is there any place where he appears to accept it? When you say, okay, no, I don't accept any of those views.
Yeah,
that's pretty similar to saying the neither nor view. I don't think either this or that.
That's why I say it sounds similar.
Yeah, so it's like, why is he rejecting the neither nor view when he comes to the conclusion that it's substantially the same?
That seems to be the case. I just want to see whether this was a very useful book that I found by Peter Harvey. It's called The Selfless Mind. Some things I disagree with in it, but he has very astute examination of some of these questions. Wrong class. Okay, he says that the view that the Tathagata he actually begins with the second view, the view that the Tathagata doesn't exist after death. And then he says, okay, this view shows that or means that the arahat or liberated person is cut off and perishes with the breakup of the body and does not exist after death. And this is clearly the view of the annihilationists, who hold that there is no rebirth of any kind for any being. So such an annihilationist view is one which posits some kind of self or a real being which is then cut off at death. Okay, then view number one, he says, this is likely to be some form of eternalism, That is a view which takes the Tathagata as some kind of self that survives death and continues to exist eternally. Okay, then he says, view three, the Tathagata both exists and does not exist after death, is simply the view that part of the Tathagata continues after death in a rebirth. That is, this is a view that there is a self that is both eternal and non-eternal. Then he mentions the sutta that I just referred to, the view that the physical senses are a non-eternal self which is destroyed at death, but the mind is an eternal self which continues after death. But then he says about the view that the Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist after death. This seems, in his view, just I'll sum it up, to be pointing to the idea that the Tathagata continues to exist in a very, very subtle form, but it's so subtle that we can't describe it either as existing or not existing. But again, he is trying to interpret that view in the light of other passages. We don't really have the view clearly explicated in the suttas, what is meant by saying that the Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist after death. We just have to try to figure it out from a number of texts. Okay, does anybody have any more questions or any comments on this? Okay, cut through. Is it a negation of what?
Is ahamkara a negation or inversion of a word called hamkara?
No. The word aham means I in Pali and Sanskrit. So kara means making or creating. So ahamkara is the creating of an I.
And mamankara is the creating of a me.
Mamankara creating mine.
Thank you.
Yes. Just a comment about this. It looks like these four views has one, at least one common shared one common thing. That is, there is a concept of self.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's why you cannot say or. There is
an
eternal existence.
Yeah. That's the very good point. That's exactly the point. That they're all based on speculating about the fate of a self, whether the self continues for eternity or whether it's annihilated. And then if the self, that metaphysical self, doesn't exist, then all of the questions become, say, wrongly formulated. Yeah, please. What is your name again?
Sam.
When you're meditating, you get to that state where it's like...
Wait, take the microphone.
When you're meditating, you get to that state sometimes where it's like the mind is outside of the body.
Yeah.
So how is that reconciled with what?
How
is that reconciled with the self or no self? Or... because like death is obviously that same...
In the Buddha's teaching, mind or consciousness continues after death, so that there is, the Buddha does affirm rebirth, but the mind or consciousness is not a self, but it's a process which is always undergoing change, always arising through conditions, somewhat like a stream or a river. So even though the waters in the river are always different, we think of it as the same, let's say the Mississippi River, which starts up in Minnesota and continues down all the way down to Mississippi, New Orleans. So we say it's the same Mississippi River, even though the waters flowing through are always different.
Would the 12-link chain help to explain this, do you think, better? Is that how the Buddha addressed this issue?
The Buddha uses the 12 links of dependent origination to clarify the way rebirth works, the causation at the bottom of the process of rebirth.
But do you think that also is his way of explaining self or soul? Would that be correct?
I wouldn't say that it's a way of explaining self or soul, but it's a way of showing how there is continuity without a self or soul or ego entity that persists across the succession of lives.
But then that would answer the question, if there's a self, because if there's no soul, obviously, then that's answered in dependent
origination. Yeah, dependent origination shows how there's continuity without persisting identity, without persisting individual identity. Okay, let us continue, because I want to finish the sutta today. Okay, now this wanderer Vajragupta apparently has not been satisfied with the Buddha's answers. So now he's going to ask basically the same question from a different point of view. And so now I'm in paragraph 16 now. He says, when a bhikkhu's mind is liberated thus, Master Gotama, where does he reappear after death? Actually, reappear is not such a good translation. I think the better translation is rebirth. Where is he reborn after death? Then the Buddha replies, the term he is reborn does not apply. So then Vajragupta draws the inference, then this must mean he is not reborn. Then the Buddha says, the term he is not reborn does not apply. Then Vajragupta says that he is both reborn and is not reborn. Buddha says this does not apply. Then he is neither reborn nor he is not reborn. This does not apply. Vajragupta says then is it the case that he is neither reborn nor not reborn? Then the Buddha says to describe him as neither reborn nor not reborn, this doesn't apply. So again, the Buddha is rejecting all four alternatives expressed in terms of rebirth. Now, I have to say that the arhat, the Buddha, the liberated person, is actually not reborn. He's not reborn, but Vajragupta is formulating these questions from his own premise, his own presupposition, still that he's taking the enlightened person to be a self or to have a self. So he's asking about rebirth in terms of what happens to the self. Is it the case that the self is reborn, or is it the case that the self is annihilated and extinguished and doesn't continue after death? Or is it the case that there's some combination of these? Or is it that the self is neither reborn nor is not reborn? Okay, so now Vajragupta expresses his puzzlement. He says, paragraph 17, he says, when you are asked these four questions, each time you reject it and say, this doesn't apply. So now he says, here I have fallen into bewilderment. I've fallen into confusion. And the trust or confidence that I had gained in you in my previous discussions with you has now disappeared. Okay, then the Buddha replies to him in a very straight and direct way. He says, this is enough for you to be bewildered. It's enough for you to be confused, because this Dhamma is profound, hard to see, hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning. It's subtle, to be experienced by the wise. It is hard for you to understand this when you hold another view. You see, Vajragupta has another point of view, which is probably some view of self. You accept another teaching. You approve of another teaching, pursue a different training, and follow a different teacher. So Vajragupta is, you say, he's obstructed by his point of view, by the teaching that he accepts. So when the Buddha rejects all four of these alternatives, he has no way of getting a grip on what the Buddha is driving at. But now the Buddha is going to use a simile or an analogy in order to try to make the point clear to him. And so the Buddha is going to take the analogy of a fire. So he says, I will question you about this, and then you answer as you see fit. Okay, it's the simile of the fire that gives the name to the sutta, why it's called Vajragupta on fire. He says, what do you think, Vajra? Suppose a fire were burning before you. Would you know that this fire is burning in front of me? Of course, he says, I would. Then, if someone were to ask you, what does this fire burning before you burn in dependence on, how would you answer? I would say that this fire burns in dependence on fuel of grass and sticks. Now, this fire analogy is quite revealing, because the fire is a process, something always changing, and we can see that it's conditioned, it depends on certain conditions. The conditions here would be the fuel, grass and sticks. And as long as we keep on feeding the fire with the fuel, with grass and sticks, the fire continues to burn. We find some indication of what is the fuel in the case of a sentient being in one of the suttas that I referred to, but that I had printed out last week. This is sutta number 9 in the Samyutta Nikaya, chapter 44. Here Vajragupta asks the Buddha, or the Buddha tells Vajragupta, just as a fire burns with fuel, but not without fuel, I declare that rebirth is for one with fuel, not for one without fuel. Then Vajragupta asks the Buddha, what is the fuel for rebirth when somebody drops this body and hasn't yet taken up another body? And then the Buddha says, when a being has laid down one body but has not yet been reborn in another body, I say that the fuel is craving. So we could say that craving, and ignorance, and all of the defilements are the fuel that keeps the process of rebirth going. Just as it's the grass and sticks that keep the fire burning. Okay, so now then the Buddha asks, if the fire before you were to be extinguished, would you know that it was extinguished? And Vajragupta says, I would know. Okay, so each time the Buddha is asking Vajragupta a question which has a clear, definite, unequivocal answer, and Vajragupta answers correctly. Okay, now the Buddha says, suppose someone were to ask you, when that fire before you was extinguished, where did it go? Did it go to the east? Did it go to the west? Did it go to the north or to the south? what would you answer? And then Vajragupta would have to answer. If someone were to ask me that, I would have to say that the question doesn't apply. The fire burned in dependence on its fuel of grass and sticks, and when that is used up, if it doesn't get any more fuel, then it is without fuel, and so we say the fire is extinguished. It seems to me to be a little problem with this analogy. What do you think? Anybody see a little problem with it?
It's easy to misinterpret it. It does not make sense.
That's also one problem, yeah. But he doesn't say about the fire that it doesn't exist. He just says that it's reckoned as extinguished.
Could it light up again?
They take the...
Could it light up again?
That's true, but it wasn't what I was thinking of.
But also...
Take the microphone again.
When you have a fire, even if it is extinguished, you still have ashes and smoke and the residue of it.
Yeah, but you could say that when the Tathagata passes away, then they cremate the body, and then you have the ashes and the relics.
But isn't that like just the same thing? Our actions continue to have consequences even after we're done doing them or saying or whatever.
In the case of an enlightened, liberated person, the actions have no more consequences. All of the actions are finished. Let me just maybe give a little hint. The problem I see is with whether this last question completely corresponds to the four alternatives. Maybe Richard maybe has it. So I'm trying. Take the microphone first.
Yeah, I think the last question is actually implies the annihilationism position. That is, it's not a denial of all four, it's a denial of existence.
Yeah, I think we're on the same track, though. I was looking at it from a slightly different perspective. What I was thinking was that, okay, go up to, if someone were to ask you, when that fire before you was extinguished, where did it go, to the east, west, north, or south, all four of those alternatives presuppose that the fire is still existing in some form. So those are four eternalist positions.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So if the fire goes out, then those eternalist positions don't apply. But it seems like one then falls into an annihilationist position. If one just says the fire has been extinguished, it's gone out, it seems like annihilationism. Yeah.
I don't know if this applies to your example, but you're comparing a fire to a self.
Yeah.
And why would we want to do that?
I'm not sure.
What I'm saying is, in some chemical reaction to a living organism, which we're defining as a self.
Yeah.
Would we put them in the same camp, or is it just an analogy?
Well, this is the way I would see it. In the Buddha's mind, the fire isn't corresponding to a self. The fire is a dynamic process which is consuming fuel. And so it's conditioned, it depends on fuel, and it's constantly consuming the fuel. That is like a living person, which depends on conditions always changing, always going through this dynamic process of through conditions, processing information, engaging in actions. That is like the fire. But let us say the deluded person will think of the fire as some kind of substantial entity. And so when the fire goes out, the person will think the fire, when it's extinguished, must have gone someplace. That is like the deluded person who thinks when the enlightened one dies, he must have gone someplace.
What he's telling Vacha is what British analytic philosophers now call, but he's making a category.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I'll talk about that for a second. A category mistake is something like this. Somebody comes to a university and asks where the university is after having seen all the parts of the university.
Yeah.
Because he had the false assumption that the university was a separate thing rather than a composite of all the parts.
Yeah, let's take Duangyan Monastery. Somebody comes here and says, this is the dining hall, that's the big Buddha hall, this is Guanyin hall, that's the lake, the garden. Yeah, continue.
I think he obviously is telling Vacha you're making a category mistake.
And
that was an idea that has existed for a long time. Aristotle had it. The thing is, I think that there's a kind of mismatch.
Yeah.
That is the analogy that he's creating is not really an analogy for that kind of category mistake, but seemingly the idea that it could be a category mistake is nevertheless still forceful. And that there should be some way of formulating that argument that would do it. I think it may be kind of a problem of wording, you know?
Yeah. Asmund.
Yeah. I get the impression that she's talking about Nibbana.
Actually, this is a very good point, a very interesting point that I should have mentioned now that you speak about this. When he's describing the fire, he says it is reckoned as extinguished. And now the Pali word for extinguished is nibbuto. It's related to the word for a fire that's extinguished is nibbuto, and nibbuto is the word that's used to describe the person who has attained nibbana. It's the word nibbuto. It's said to be related to the word nibbana. Nibbana is sort of the abstract noun, the state, you could say, and nibbuto describes the person who has attained nibbana. Was that the point you... Yeah, that was very important. I should have caught that word, extinguished. Okay, but now, if we look at what the conclusion seems to come through ordinarily with the fire, you know, when a fire goes out, it's extinguished. Looking at it from one angle, it seems almost to me as if that is supporting the annihilationist position that when somebody attains nibbana, then passes away, it just goes out completely like a fire, nothing at all absolutely remains. But then we go on to the next passage, and let's take a look at that. Okay, so now the Buddha continues. Okay, Vajragupta says, the fire that has gone out is nibbuto. In a sense, it's attained nibbana. And so the Buddha now says, so too, Vacha, the Tathagata has abandoned that material form by which one describing him might describe him. He has cut it off at the root, made it like a palm stump, done away with it, so that it is no longer subject to future arising. The Tathagata is liberated from reckoning or from any kind of judgment or determination in terms of material form. He is profound, immeasurable, hard to fathom, like the ocean. So to say he is reborn does not apply. He is not reborn doesn't apply. He is both reborn and not reborn doesn't apply. He is neither reborn nor not reborn does not apply. The Tathagata then, it just continues with the other four aggregates. The Tathagata has abandoned that feeling, that perception, those volitional activities, that consciousness by which one describing him might describe him. He's cut it off at the root, made it like a palm stump, done away with it so that it is no longer subject to future arising. He is liberated from reckoning in terms of consciousness. He is profound, immeasurable, hard to fathom, like the ocean. And so the four alternatives do not apply. So what seems to be the implication of this passage? Yeah.
Well, I think saying that the reason it doesn't apply is
it's because it's an issue of identity. He's saying that there's nothing that is that once one becomes a Tathagata, there is no identity which can be judged one way or another. Presumably either before or after death. That is, other people may attribute qualities to one.
Yeah.
But he doesn't actually have them. It's misperception.
Yeah, that's very good.
Yeah.
Does anybody else have any thoughts about this?
What comes to mind is that he's saying that samsara stops.
Yeah. Wait, say again.
He is saying that samsara stops.
Yeah.
The consciousness process goes out.
Yeah. Well, what we call samsara is really the continuity or the play of these five aggregates. So the Tathagata has abandoned the five aggregates. And now he's saying, though, what strikes me, he's saying that the Tathagata has abandoned the five aggregates, and so he is now becomes profound, immeasurable, hard to fathom like the ocean. And to my mind, it raises the question, is this text speaking about the Tathagata while he's continuing to live or after death? Maybe I'm still in the shoes of Vajragupta. Certainly, while the Buddha is living, you say he's abandoned the five aggregates in that he no longer has any attachment to them, no longer any identification with them. He's given them up completely. Okay, so we can't describe him in terms of the five aggregates, can't reckon him in terms of the five aggregates. But is this saying that the Tathagata is deep, immeasurable, like the great ocean? While he's alive, of course that's true, but also after he passes away? That's not so clear to me from this sutta. Is it clear to anybody else? So you're taking it to be referring to his life, his existence while he's alive.
So, also, he's saying it seems like it's just like the Dhamma. It's so hard to grasp.
To me,
that's all I take from it. But also, I'm assuming. I'm not there yet, obviously. But when you get to the enlightened state, that is like a rebirth in itself. Because you're kind of shedding away a lot of, all of your, wants and desires and whatever it is that keeps us in this state of rebirth. So, I mean, in some ways it seems like he's referring to that as a rebirth.
No, I don't think certainly achieving the enlightened state is a monumental transformation, but we wouldn't use the word rebirth to refer to that. It's a little bit like the Christian idea of being reborn, right. But when the word being reborn is used in Buddhist context, it means actually giving up this body and passing on to a new state of existence. I just want to finish quickly, well, maybe before finishing the sutta, let us go to, it was one of the suttas that I had in the handout that I didn't take. This was the one from the first sutta of the Samyutta Nikaya, chapter 44. Okay, in this sutta, there is a bhikkhuni, a nun by the name of Kema. And she was the one who the Buddha praised as the foremost of the nuns with regard to wisdom. Okay, so she was traveling through the country of Kosala, and then King Pasenadi, the king of Kosala, heard about her and came to her. And then King Pasenadi gets into the act, and he asks Bhikkhuni Kema these four questions. Does the Tathagata exist after death? And Kema says, the Buddha hasn't declared this, and so on, with the four alternatives. But then King Pasenadi is confused by this and say, how is it that the Buddha doesn't proclaim any of these four alternatives? And now Kema says to the king, I will question you about this matter. Answer as you see fit. So Kema is going to use a simile or an analogy also, but a different one from the one that the Buddha uses. The Buddha uses the simile of fire, but Kema is going to use the simile of the grains of sand in the river Ganges. And so she asks, what do you think, great king? Do you have an accountant or calculator or mathematician who can count the grains of sand in the river Ganges and say there are so many grains of sand, hundreds of grains, thousands of grains, hundreds of thousands of grains of sand? And King Pasenadi says, no, reverend lady. Then King Bhikkhuni Kema says, a different analogy. Do you have an accountant, mathematician, who can count the water in the great ocean and say there are so many gallons of water, so many hundreds of gallons, thousands of gallons, hundreds of thousands of gallons? And the king says, no, revered lady. Why so? Because the great ocean is deep, immeasurable, hard to fathom. And so now Kema says, so too, great king, that form by which one describing the Tathagata might describe him has been abandoned by the Tathagata, cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, obliterated so that it is no more subject to future arising. The Tathagata is liberated from reckoning in terms of form, again, feeling, perception, the mental activities, consciousness. He is deep, immeasurable, hard to fathom like the great ocean. The Tathagata exists after death, doesn't apply. He doesn't exist, doesn't apply. He both exists and doesn't exist after, doesn't apply. He neither exists nor does not exist after death. This does not apply. Okay, and then King Pasenadi, at a later time, he meets the Buddha. He asks the Buddha the same questions, and the Buddha answers in exactly the same way. And then King Pasenadi is amazed that both Bhikkhuni and the Buddha have answered in exactly the same way. Okay, so here, you know, I can't give a determined, the definitive and decisive solution to this problem, but it seems to me that in this sutta, when the king is questioning Bhikkhuni Kema, she's replying that the Buddha is immeasurable, incalculable, hard to fathom, that she's speaking about the Tathagata after death, not while he's alive. That's my impression. So it seems to me that here the simile of the great ocean is leaning a little bit in the direction of eternalism. So we have the simile of the fire, which if you take it very literally, it seems to be pointing somewhat in the direction of annihilation, And the simile of the great ocean, which is hard to fathom, immeasurable, hard to fathom, seems to be pointing a little bit in the direction of eternalism. So my impression, this is my understanding, that the Buddha is using these two similes of the extinguished fire and the unfathomable ocean to balance each other out. Because if you take just the simile of the fire being extinguished, it would seem to lead the questioner in the direction of annihilationism, because he'll misunderstand it. And if you just take the simile of the great ocean, then on its own it would lead the questioner in the direction of eternalism by misunderstanding. But by putting the two together, the Buddha seems to me, my understanding, to be indicating that what is meant by the Tathagata here after death is actually Nibbana itself. So the Tathagata attains Nibbana, and so there's nothing really surviving of the individual Tathagata in Nibbana. But to counter the view that Nibbana is not a state of just complete annihilation, a state of nothingness, but rather an unconditioned reality, a real state that's unconditioned, without birth, without change, without perishing, the Buddha compares the state of the Tathagata to the great ocean.
I don't see the fire analogy as being that example of annihilation. I think it has to be an example of eternalism, because the fire doesn't exist for that fuel, but the fire still exists. The concept of fire...
You mean other fires exist?
Yes, we don't see that fire there, but fire still exists. So I see that as...
That's a way to look at it. In fact, some of the interpreters of early Buddhism, let's say the early interpreters of early Buddhism, like some of the 19th century or early 20th century German scholars of Buddhism, pointed out that in early Indian thought, maybe in the Vedic period, perhaps even in the Buddha's lifetime, the idea prevailed that fire exists everywhere. The element of fire exists everywhere. So when a fire goes out, it doesn't mean that it completely vanishes or disappears the way we ordinarily think of a fire going out, but rather when the fire goes out, it just merges into this imperceptible, omnipresent fire element. But I'm not sure whether in the Buddha's time that idea was still prevalent. It seems to me that when the Buddha is speaking about the passing away, passing out of a fire, he's just speaking in common sense terms. Just to point out, the basic point is to indicate that when a fire goes out, to ask where does it go is a mistaken question. It's what Richard called a category mistake.
So the difference I see between annihilation...
Maybe take the microphone.
The difference I see between annihilation and the fire simile is that fire exists as long as someone is feeding more fuel into it. And what is that the mechanism of feeding?
Yeah.
It would be craving.
Yeah, yeah.
But the moment you stop feeding, it will burn out whatever it's it's extinguished.
Yeah.
Now, annihilationism seems like for no real reason it will just stop.
Yeah.
It will be powered for no cause.
Yeah.
On its own, it just stops at the end.
Yeah. Okay, that's a good point. And what I say is that the fire simile, when I say that it points in the direction of annihilation, I'm not saying that it implies the annihilationist view. And I'm not saying that the ocean simile implies the eternalist view. It's just that, let us say, the suggestive power of the similes point a little bit in that direction. But certainly it's not affirming either of these views, because from the Buddha's standpoint, both of these views are founded on the mistaken presupposition that there is a self which is either eternalized, or which either exists for eternity, or else is annihilated. And both of those views are wrong. What the enlightened person, what any person is a process of the five aggregates, an integrated process of the five aggregates, which continues through the fuel of craving and clinging. And when craving and clinging are removed, then that process comes to an end. So there is a stopping of the process of the five aggregates that we call personal existence, individual existence, that comes to an end. But then I think the great ocean simile is brought in to suggest that the end of the process, it's not just like the annihilationist imagined, just a blank of nothingness, but there is this nibbana element which remains.
Seems like this is something in other subject matter we deal with all the time. Obviously, the world of physics has dealt with first a luminous earth ether to try to frame exact placement of things, and that underlying tendency was, you know, that absolute idea had to be questioned to make further progress. So there's a grid applied of time and space, and now we're at a point where to reconcile other problems, we have to get rid of the absolute. You know, a long time ago, or rather 100 years ago or so, someone said, let's just apply this time-space.
Yeah.
But now we have to go back and say, oh, we really maybe shouldn't have been so absolute about that, because it was just laid there to help other equations come forward. Yeah. And so now at this point, in science and physics, there's an effort to remove time from all equations to see what properties come forward without time. So Julien Barbar is the man who's famous, or well known for this, although many do.
Who?
Julien Barbour. You can see him on his website, platonia.com. He's a person who is one of many scientists who do this, but he is a scholar who lives on a farm outside of a paycheck from a university. So he says he's had the good fortune to not be employed by a university and thereby be constricted. He's been able to, as a Russian translator, Russian English translator, been able to rework physics without being constrained by the university. So my long-winded point here was, it's a way to learn is to maybe set up temporary absolutes, but it's, at the end of the day, a very honest take is to have to say, technically, I can't see that, I can't know that, and to have to sort of live with that until someone should perhaps become a Buddha themselves.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay, I think we'll have to stop now, and then we can come back maybe 12:10, 12:15, that we could have some discussion. Okay, we end with the sharing of the merits. Okay, we share the merits with all beings, wishing them to be well and happy. Akasa ta jabhuma ta deva naga mehetika punyanta namumodipa chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasa ta jabhuma ta deva naga mehetika punyanta namumodipa chirang rakantu desanam. Akasa ta jabhuma ta deva naga mahidika punyanta nanumodipa chirang rakantu mangparam. Etta vata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Eta vata cham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Eta vata cham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe sadanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya pavagupadaya avicheta etantare satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha pasanya sanino dukkha pamuchantu pusantu nibbutin. Okay, then we could stand, and then we do with three bells. Good.
Okay, fine.